This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Ben Barakoff, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, thanks for having me on here. It's a real honor to be chatting with you today, Mark.
Took a little bit just to find a window between when you were done some of your capture work and before Christmas, so it's pretty cool to squeeze this in a few days before Christmas. It's coming out after Christmas, like in the new year, but just to let folks know, it's we are recording before Christmas, and you got your poinsettia in the window back there.
Yep, that's right. The family's got this is not our real Christmas tree, but our little fake one there in the back corner, and all the Christmas pillows out. Yeah, everybody's all excited for the season.
Yeah, we're getting there. Just my wife's down doing a grocery shop right now, so we do a wild game dinner for Christmas now. We've switched over that, and so I've tried to hand off the chef baton to the kids this year. And so earlier this fall, it's like, hey, what do you want to do for the wild Christmas dinner? And they're like, tacos. So it's going to be a wild taco dinner, taco bar, pulled moose, pulled goose meat, and I'm going to do some fish tacos. So I'm going to fry up some perch from ice fishing last winter. So that's our Christmas dinner.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. I want to come over for that.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We got sick of turkey, so.
Yeah, that's funny that we just talk about that, because I was mentioning that to my wife this morning. I said, well, can we have tacos for Christmas instead of turkeys?
Well, now you can. Hey, yeah. Mark's family. Yeah. What the heck?
Yeah, we could have some elk meat tacos.
No, that's pretty cool. So, Ben, you are a helicopter pilot. You are the president of Canadian Wildlife Captures and a hunter.
Yeah, you betcha. Yeah, I sort of feel pretty fortunate to be able to integrate some of my passions into a career that I've been really focused on for the last 11 years. Yeah, and it gets me out in the field a lot, which is what I really like. I'm a helicopter pilot, but I always sort of consider myself not really a pilot. I just like being out in the outdoors. Operating machinery was one of the things that I was always interested in. Helicopters seemed to be the ultimate machine, and one thing sort of led to another. And now I find myself... it's not a full year-round gig, but the wildlife capture stuff involving helicopters is at least 6 months out of the year. And then it's sort of also, it's also gone into some ground-based stuff as well. So we've been doing some deer captures on the ground, cougar captures by darting with dogs, and yeah, all kinds of neat stuff. And the best part is meeting all the neat, interesting biologists, veterinarians, and stuff along the way, and some of their passions and how they got into those fields as well.
Yeah, I bet you that's fascinating. And just you're traveling all over the province doing this work, correct?
Western Canada. We've been Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta. The last 7 years has been primarily in British Columbia. It seems like there's a little extra funding, a few extra projects that has been able to keep us busy here home in British Columbia. But yeah, I feel super fortunate to be able to have explored most corners of the province, and
very
we truly live in an incredible place here in British Columbia. Like, I still have to pinch myself every time.
Yeah, and I'm like out there just saying, like, meeting people and stuff. You know, it's kind of like the, you know, doing a deer capture in the Southern Okanagan or whatever. It's like people are kind of like a certain culture, and then you go up to Fort Nelson or Fort St. John or something like that, and the communities are very different. Like, the landscape and the wildlife and the ecosystems are different, and I've always found traveling in this province, then the people are different, the communities are different, and then Canada itself is like that, right? Like, East Coast to West Coast. Like, what a super exciting, you know, job you got. Like you said, I can just envision this, like, blending all of these passions, like, as a hunter and conservation and, yeah, just being out. So, I mean, the machine's your office, but it's like you're outside, right? Like, you're just windows all around you. And
that's right. Yeah. It's so far outside of a normal helicopter pilot's sort of daily job. You have to be interested in it. I've tried to train a couple of pilots that weren't hunters for wildlife capture work. And if you're not passionate about it, you're not going to put in the effort that's required to be successful at it, because it is, it's outside a normal helicopter pilot's realm. That's for sure.
Huh? So what are the, we'll just dive into this. So what are the attributes of being a hunter, like the skill set, and like, I'm going to guess there's got to be a little bit of a, like, oh, hey, there's a deer bedded down right below that bluff by that tree. Do you see it?
Yes.
So what are those skills, like, as a hunter that you're bringing from ground level to a pilot that has capture technicians in the back that just puts you above that these other folks haven't grasped?
Right. It probably, I think the single most thing is finding the animals. I think a lot of time there's a misconception that if you're in a helicopter, you just magically see animals all over the place, but it's truly not the case. If you're going to catch some elk, where are you going to go find them? And is it in a place that you can actually get them into an opening and get a net on them and successfully capture them? Sometimes, like, ungulates are probably a little bit easier because there's lots of numbers and they're easier to find. But tracking wolves, like, we do a lot of wolf capture stuff, tracking wolves, being persistent with it. Where are the wolves going to travel to? And it's pretty easy if you get snow every second day and you can pick up on a fresh track, you follow it for 15 minutes and you'll hook up with the pack of wolves. But it's like knowing which way they're going. Is this track a day old? Or is it 5 days old? Is it 2 weeks old? If it is, it hasn't snowed for a week, where are they going to be? There's no point in looking around where you are. They're probably going to be 100 kilometers away. So it's just having that sort of hunter instinct to say, like, oh, well, they were here, but they're not anymore. But where did they go?
Right.
Yeah. Right. And just being persistent with that.
Yeah, and that's a key thing with hunting, right, is patience and persistence and
yep,
and that knowledge of the game. So yeah. That's interesting what you said, is like, then the animals still have to be somewhere out. You know, like, you're not going to do a capture when they're in the dense forest or in the thickets in the riparian area. So it's like, okay, what's the pattern of these elk for the day? They're in the river bottom during the day, and then at night they come out and feed on this open hillside, and we've got to be there at daybreak before they move back into the, just like a exactly. hunter. That
just sounds like a hunter,
very,
yeah.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
Very yeah. cool. So walk us through kind of a scenario, like a capture scenario, like, what, you know, how does it unfold? Like, from briefings to, you know, what the biologists want, to how you work with your team and actually right. execute that in the field.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'll refer to what I was just doing. I just got home yesterday afternoon after being out in the field for 3 weeks, and we were focused on doing mule deer captures in southern BC. It's part of the Southern Interior Mule Deer Project, which is the longest, largest mule deer project in BC's history. And I think it was planned for a 5-year study, and I think we're year 7, or it possibly could be even year 8 now. There's just a bunch of PhD students and university students that are working with the data that's being collected out in the field. So that's why it's still continuing on a little bit longer than originally intended. So we've changed a little bit along this data collection. We're primarily, up until this year, we were catching juveniles. So fawns that have, they would have been born in June, mid-June, and then we catch them in December, and we would measure their body fat, and weight, size, dimensions, of course, blood, GPS collars, and whatnot. This year we were catching adult doe fawns, and to measure their body fat going into winter. But I'm probably skipping ahead there a little bit. So we've been catching them in December. We got 3 study areas that we've been working on. One would be Cache Creek. The other one would be the West Okanagan Valley. And the other one is the boundary. So Grand Forks to Midway area. And those 3 study areas have some unique, what would you call it? Unique landscapes where they've been altered over the few years by a few different things, drought, forest fires, and they're also their natural grasslands for wintry mule deer. So that's what I think why they would select those 3 areas. So when we go out there, we get all our collars ordered. This year's task was to collar 30 adults in each of the study areas, or at least 30, maybe 32, just so that you have, if one dies, they still have a sample size of at least 30 adults tested this year. Go out there. Those projects, a couple of the experienced provincial biologists were doing the neck gunning. So I have a couple of neck gunners that work for me throughout the winter, but there is a couple of experienced neck gunner biologists that I was working with. So our crew would be myself as the pilot, the biologist as the neck gunner, and then we would also bring another biologist as a, we call it like a mugger handler or helper. We go out in the morning, go find some mule deer in catchable spots. So over the course of like the last 7 winters, working the same study areas, we know some areas, some like southern aspect grasslands that we can catch the deer. So really when we find the deer, we need to line it all up so that the deer goes through an opening large enough that we can swoop down with the helicopter and get a net on it safely. If the animal is standing out in the middle of the opening, it's not like you just rush in there and just like get a net on it. Mule deer, of course, very fast. When they're scared, they're even faster. They'll put their ears back. They'll run at 50 miles an hour, and that's no word of a lie. So to get it all lined up, we assess where the deer is and how we need it to run through an opening. And so we haze the animal maybe downhill a little bit so that we can turn it and run it uphill, so that it's running a little bit slower, so that when the net is on it, it's not going to tumble too hard, break a leg, or possibly break a neck can happen. Mm-hmm. Once that animal, we swoop in there, get a net on it. Once that animal is entangled in the net, the neck gunner jumps out immediately, secures the animal, make sure it can't get out of the net, and then I'll just position the helicopter away 20 meters or so away, and the mugger will jump out, and we just physically restrain the animal by putting a blindfold on it and hobbling the front and back legs together with, it looks like kind of a large dog collar. This secures the animal so that it can't kick you and it can't get up and get away. The samples that we're doing for the mule deer project, like I was mentioning, was measuring body fat with ultrasound. So we would measure a maximum body fat, and that varies with age of deer, and also probably with the summer forage that I could find. So I think what they're finding with some of that body fat measurements is that our drought years, these deer are going into winter a little bit skinnier than ideal. And they're saying that there's a correlation there. You know, prior to working with these mule deer, I always thought that mule deer was survival, or populations were pretty much correlated with winter range. So if we take away all their winter range, like say from high fencing or urban sprawl, whatnot, that these deer wouldn't be able to survive. But apparently that's not really the case. Like, if they go into winter fat and healthy because they have had a good summer forage, they can pretty much live through any winter. So even right. if it snows, like, a lot of snow, that they, if they go in healthy into winter, they can usually make it through.
Yeah. I had a worked with a biologist one time that sort of echoed the same thing, that he said basically, like, their fall and summer range has got to be in good condition so they can just pack on the weight. And then there's these, you know, good fat that the fawns reach a certain body mass, the fat content's there. Cause he said, you know, the reason they move to the winter range is cause it's where there's the least amount of snow, which is the least amount of energy to walk around. But he said the food quality, no matter what, on the winter range, he said, is basically like eating a diet of popcorn for the winter. Yeah. So it's like, you know, could you imagine, like, three times a day eating popcorn all winter long? It's like, you better start out with a lot of reserves. So I've never forgot that, you know, that analogy of, like, living on popcorn. So, I mean, that's cool to learn that stuff. I just, I love it. I find it so fascinating. So when you first go out in the morning, do you kind of do like a high flight and then sort of like, okay, there's some deer on that hillside, do a little bit of a, like a few turns, kind of get like a bit of a game plan, and then kind of like.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. Sometimes we'll do a bit of an overflight over like a series of maybe openings or grasslands and find a couple groups of deers. And then we can kind of make a bit of a game plan. So it's like, okay, well, let's get ourselves prepared. Let's catch one there. We'll catch one there. We'll catch one there. We'll catch one there. And then, and move on. And with these deer, the sampling, we're doing the ultrasound. We're weighing them as well. And then all the measurements, like, so body dimension measurements, neck girth, body length, metatarsus length, blood. It takes a little bit longer than normal capture sampling program. Like, so we're usually about 20 minutes to 30 minutes for handling. From the time we get the net out to the time we release the deer is about 20 to 30 minutes. So we're catching about roughly 10 deer a day. It's kind of daylight hours are kind of short at this time of year. Of course, today's the shortest day of the year, right? It's winter solstice today. So the days are short. We're just catching maybe 8 to 12 deer a day would be a typical day. And like you mentioned, you kind of try and plan out your day accordingly. And sometimes like an overflight, let's say there's a bunch of deer here, there's a bunch of deer over there. Yeah.
So once the crew's on the ground, the mugger, I'm like, mugger. Of all names, like, you think that they would have come up, because the analogy's right of the little old lady in her purse on the street. And it's like, hey, what do you do for a living? So do you, once they're on the ground, do you just go look for somewhere where you can just put the machine down, and then when they're done, they're going to have to, like, hoof her up to where you're sitting?
Yeah. Typically, you can land the helicopter right beside the animal. And when we sort of select our capture spot, like, say it's out in a field or a meadow or maybe some sagebrush, grassland, the helicopter that we utilize, the Hughes 500, it can land on fairly off-level ground. It has short rotor diameter, high tail rotor. You can land it pretty much anywhere. Quite often we can land right there. We won't land right beside the deer. Even just the deer in the net sometimes isn't totally 100% secure. Like, sometimes they have it maybe entangled around one or two legs, but they can still jump and bounce, or possibly they could pull out of the net even once the net gunner gets his hands on it. Sometimes it's a bit to handle. So we will quite often drop the net gunner off right away, reposition the helicopter just maybe 20 meters away, something like that. Okay. And then shut down there.
Yeah.
So we're just landing right beside. There's not too often where we can't land right where the deer is. Sometimes if it's a steeper ground, I'll have to land maybe 100 meters away at most. Typically we're not catching the deer on the steeper ground just because you can get them running uphill often. But once you get the net on them, they'll quickly stop, and then they can tumble down the hill. And that's where you can end up with broken limbs or broken neck as well. So quite often we're selecting a spot that is just slight incline uphill.
Okay. Yeah. So it's safe for the animal when it goes.
Exactly.
Cool. Yeah. How low do you need to get for the net gunners? Like, what's the 50 miles
it's
an
close.
Hour?
Like, it's close, like 5 meters. 5 yards.
Okay.
That's like a typical shot. You could probably, maybe 10 yards would be a longer shot. But these deer are, especially this year, there's no snow really at all. Like, there's only a couple inches of snow in most locations. The deer, they're running very fast. So
they're giving her.
If the helicopter's traveling at the same speed as the deer, you essentially can shoot the net right at the deer. But if you're like 10 yards or further, you have to shoot ahead of it. You have to lead it, just like as if you're shooting a duck and it's flying.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot for a net gunner there. And there's all the different parameters. Like if you're flying into the wind, a strong wind, that also slows the net down. So you have to lead it by even more if you're flying into the wind. If you're flying downwind, the net will go farther, and the downwash of the helicopter will actually carry the net much further. So you're almost shooting behind it. Even though the deer is running, you're shooting behind it because the net will get carried by the downwash and the prevailing wind. Yeah, there's a lot going on there. And if you're shooting downhill, you got to shoot
the internal in what's the internal company rubber chicken award if they miss and somebody's got to go find a net laying on the hillside?
Yep, we're picking up nets all the time. Some, especially with these mule deer in like low snow years, yeah, there's missed nets for sure. Yeah, and usually it's me that's packing the nets.
Yeah, because they get into that slightly broken ground, and they're kind of like they got that bounce thing, right, which could be a slight bounce to the left at the right at the second that the nets release. So I could appreciate that.
Yeah, that's quite often what happens when you pull up with the helicopter. They'll be running fairly straight until you get, you know, you're closing that last couple of yards, and then they realize that I'm about to get captured by this thing chasing me, and then they'll start to deke and dart and go the other way. There's a bunch of little techniques that we use to sort of prevent that. Like I say, if we're chasing a deer through a small opening, we wait till they get maybe 2/3 away across the opening so that they have a target. So now they're like, oh boy, this thing's chasing me, but they're close enough to say a tree, a bush, or the tree line that they think they can make it. So like you can sort of read their eyes, what they're doing and their demeanor and it's kind of like, let's just wait till it has a target. It's running for a target. It's committed to that target. Now it's going to run straight. We can fly in there and then net it without it deking off or taking a sharp turn, just like you had mentioned.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what are some of the nuances between the different species that kind of make it easier or harder? Like, I mean, you know, something like moose in the far north where they're up to their bellies in snow must be a very different scenario than what you're just describing.
Yeah. If there's deep snow, one of the things that I appreciate about that is that you can't break the animals. Like, it doesn't matter if they fall or they're going running downhill. Well, they're not really running because there's such deep snow, but you can't injure an animal very easily if there's deep snow. So that's always a luxury if we're working in deep snow. Sometimes we've had, like working around Prince George with caribou, there's so much powder snow that the snow is to their back. Like they're actually swimming through the snow, so they're moving very slowly. But then you also have other difficulties is when you put a net onto that, really just a neck and a head sticking up above the snow, the net never gets down to its feet to entangle it. So it's just kind of like swimming along with a net over its head.
Draped over its head.
Yeah. So there's some difficulties to every situation.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's a preference. It's a lot. The more snow, the better, the safer. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Some species you have to watch out for avalanches. Like we've done goats in the winter, and those are always, you can control where the animal that you capture is, but then you're also going to displace the other goats in the group outside of their sort of safe living area. And where are you going to displace them to? Are you going to displace them into an avalanche chute where there's potential that they're going to trigger an avalanche or get caught in that.
Yeah. So much.
And caribou too. Yeah, lots. That was to think about. Yeah, yeah. So we like lots of snow, but sometimes snow in certain habitats can create other hazards too.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And the safety of everybody there and the ground and what are they going to be stepping onto and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, we always talk, like, as hunters, just kind of switch mindsets, you know, a little bit. Like, we always talk about, you know, like, hunters, they're always giving back to conservation. And, you know, there's a certain kind of, like, responsibility and, you know, a reward associated with that, even if it's just, like, you have a membership with, you know, like, the Wild Sheep Society, and you know they're doing these, and you read about it in the magazine, you're like, I'm helping with that. But, you know, tell us about, like, just kind of your feelings. Like this is your job, you know, like, yeah. Like you're employing people to do this, you're getting paid for it. But step outside of that little bit of just, like, the lens of a hunter and what you've done in the past and what you know you have coming up. Like, how does that really, like, touch your heart? Like, how does it make you feel what you're giving back?
Yeah, good question. Because, yeah, I'm super passionate about it. And I guess what would that be? I think it's a connection with the lifestyle, like a hunting, gathering lifestyle. I grew up with that, always hunting and fishing and foraging and the outdoor lifestyle. And I think that there's a lot of people that are like-minded, such as yourself, I know for sure, and a lot of people, and I think I want to try and preserve that, or maybe make sure that it's a part of my kids' lives, and that it's preserved for other families that are also have that same mindset.
Because you're involved on, like, the science side of things, right? You know, like, it's, these are researchers, they're putting collars, they're trying to understand what they're doing, they're trying to understand
body
conditions of the animals, and we all talk about, like, that's the kind of objective information we need to help ensure hunting is sustainable.
And I'll be the first one to question if I think that a project doesn't have a good scientific purpose. It's like, why are we doing this? The animals don't want to be caught. Going out there and catching the animals and putting collars on them isn't going to increase the population. It's not going to preserve them. So I feel strongly about the projects that we work on. Is it worthwhile? Is it good? Is it giving back to wildlife? Are we learning something from this? Or are we just, quite often we study things to death, right? Where, you know, is there a long-term purpose for this? Or what are we trying to learn from this? And where is it going?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I mean, I don't do the type of stuff that you do, but I look at a lot of things exactly the same way, kind of, you know, thinking there's some things we just study too much. You just see grad student after PhD student. It's sort of like, like I'm doing a urban wildlife study. And it's like, really? It's like you study more animals that live in towns or wolves and bears. It's like there's a lot of people want to study wolves and bears. And it's like, well, what about porcupines? You know, it's like, you know, geez, nobody wants to study them. But I'm like, I'm very concerned about their populations in the Southern Rockies. Like, but nobody cares, right? And it's like, got to study the seawolves. So I'm glad you stand up a little bit like that. I think that must be the hunter's heart that's inside you.
That's right. And that's a hard one to explain to people too. Whereas I think there's a common misconception that hunters want to kill everything, right? But it's not the case with the majority of hunters out there. That's for sure, is that they really truly care about the animals. Yes, they harvest them, which involves killing them, which is a hard one to explain to a non-hunter. I mean, you could try to, but it's hard. A hard one for non-hunters to grasp is that you're killing animals that you actually care about. But
it's kind of always the individual and then the greater good of the species, you know, so.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Do you end up talking to a lot of hunters, say like a couple things, explaining to them what you're doing? Because I've seen the odd thing where hunters are like, hey, we're just harassing the animals, you know, with the helicopter and this. And you kind of got to, well, you know, from a person that does this, you know, do you have those types of things? And then on the, so that would be kind of like the, you know, addressing sort of like negative attitudes. And then do you find yourself like talking to other hunters going, hey, you know what? Like, I used to think that, you know, this is what the mule deer did and, you know, the cougars were killing all this, but, you know, I've been on this project for 6 years and this is what I'm actually seeing, like an education component to what you're doing. So sort of the, you know, are you dispelling some myths and are you helping to educate?
Yeah, whenever I get a chance, I try and like relay the stuff that we're working on and where it's going and what people are finding out. Yeah, I try and share all of that stuff for sure. I have lots of friends as hunters, so I'm always trying to promote them to do what they can. And if it just comes from like, say, a fellow like guide for the elk hunter around here at home here in Powell River, he was hunting up north and he witnessed lots of predation on caribou and sheep over the last like 5 years in this area that he jet boats into. And I said, hey, you know what? Call this guy. This is the guy. This is his phone number. Just tell him what you saw out there, because you're the guy, you're the eyes on the ground, you're concerned about it. And not to say that somebody's going to do something about it, but at least those talk to somebody that's concerned about it or express your concerns and try and relay that. That's
a little bit of ambassador work there, connecting hunters with the right people. That's cool. So do you get any negative stuff from the hunting community? Like, you know,
why I don't think so. Or, I've heard
you're
a couple
just out there finding where all the big bucks live, right?
So. Oh, I'm sure that everybody thinks that about like the work that we do is like, oh yeah, you know where all the animals. I've had that for sure.
Okay.
I do some elk guiding for the local outfitter here in Powell River. I do like one or two a year, but I've had that from other people. They're like, well, you know exactly where all the elk are. I'm like, well, I don't. I mean, I know where they live, the valleys, but so do you. I was like, I don't. You still got to go out there and hunt it. I have no other advantages any other way than anybody else. But I've also had comments, I know, about some of the stuff that we're working on in the Fraser River with the sheep and the MOV project. Yep. And there's, I want to say it's mostly probably just outfitters that have negative comments about it. And not all of them. There's definitely some that are very supportive for sure, but they're negative comments. We're out there, we're catching like pretty much every female sheep and even some of the rams as well, and putting collars, temporary collars on them all. And I guess from an outfitter standpoint, if you bring a hunter in and you see all these sheep running around with orange collars on, it's not an ideal situation. And of course, they're not happy about anything that's going on because the sheep are dying and they're losing quota, and you know, that's money in their pocket. So I can understand that, you know, someone might be questioning the process and procedures, but I mean, truly it's in their best interest, because it's a, you know, that's a herd that's just steady declining for year after year after year. And, the government and the Sheep Society, Wild Sheep Society, BC and Wild Sheep Foundation are trying to reverse that trend and get populations back to favorable numbers for everybody.
Yeah, I can definitely understand, like, you know, seeing a collar on the animal, like with your hunter, because it's sort of like, well, actually other humans have actually touched that animal, right? So like it kind of changes, you know, the feeling a little bit. But also, we're also, like you just said, we're in a time frame where we're either those sheep are going to be there in 50 years from now or they're not. And if folks listening to this haven't seen the Wild Sheep Society's film Transmission, that's on this Fraser Valley herd. And I just remember it had a big impact on me that I think one of the stats was is this herd had not produced a lamb, because the MOVI kills the lamb like in their first 6 to 9 months of age or something like that. And they hadn't produced a lamb that made it to age 12. And like whatever it was, you know, 10 years or something like that. And they were capturing animals, euthanizing animals with MOVI. And within a couple of years, I think they had like a dozen lambs that survived past a year old kind of story. And
yeah. Yeah. It's a huge success story. It's pretty exciting to be working on a project where you're reversing that trend, where the sheep are surviving and the lambs are living. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that must feel pretty good. That's, yeah. You know, that's one where they're going to look back 100 years from now and say, hey, these are what these people were doing. So hopefully your name's remembered as being a part of that. So yeah, there was somebody that was helping out with that sheep. Like a guy used to wander around and pick up the nets that were missed on the hillside. I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
Well, we'll make sure everybody remembers your name.
Yeah. Hopefully it passes down. Yeah. Yeah. And somebody else will take the lead to, yeah. We were out just catching some sheep there on Monday, I think it was, a few of the leftover of the chasm herd just by Clinton, just on the east side of Clinton. And that's a real sad story where it used to be a pretty healthy population of about 120 California bighorn sheep, and a farmer there brought in a couple of domestic sheep and they contracted MOVI from the domestic sheep and they started to die off. They had a big die off for a few years, and then it's just been so trickled down. 3 years ago we went there and did test and remove. It was pretty easy to do the test and remove there because there was only 12 animals left. That was 3 years ago. Right after the test and remove, there was six lambs born from six ewes, and four of them survived into winter. Fast forward 2 years into this spring, there was lambs born again, but they all disappeared come mid-July, which is pretty telltale story of how MOVI works, is that lambs are born, within six weeks, they're gone. And when we went out there, there was a ram that was unaccounted for, where I don't know where he came from. It's never been captured before, was never tested before. Wasn't part of the herd, so maybe it wandered from the Fraser River, or who knows. Sometimes the rams can wander pretty far, maybe the Marble Range. But we captured them, and we couldn't actually net gun them in the forested terrain around that area, so we ended up darting them with chemical immobilization. And shortly after we darted it, we could see that the ram was coughing, and so we landed the helicopter, walked in there and processed them. So what we would do is we'd test them. So a nasal swab, we'd take blood, put a GPS collar on them. And then because this one was chemically immobilized, we reversed the drug, the mobilizing drug, and the ram comes awake and walks away. Well, when this one woke up, he is coughing, sounded terrible. You could tell he was pretty sick. And, we probably, you could have just euthanized it because it's clear that he has pneumonia. Not for sure that it's got MOVI. It could have something else, but he's got a GPS collar on now, and I'm sure that's kind of what's leading, is that they recontracted MOVI from a sick ram that had wandered into that small group of sailors. There's only eight sheep left there now, and I'm sure that ram will... He's actively shedding the MOVI. I'm sure he is. I mean, the tests will prove that in the next coming couple of weeks. But yeah. So hopefully the Wild Sheep Society BC, like, they're pushing for government to make a policy to prevent domestic sheep coming into wild sheep habitats. And I think that there's three pretty solid ways to prevent that, and there's a policy where you don't have any domestic sheep in wild sheep habitat, or if you do, you bring domestic sheep in, you have to have them tested regularly, and if there's any sheep that else like come added to the herd, they need to be tested. Or double fencing, if you're gonna have domestic sheep in wild sheep habitat, you got a double fence to keep them from passing that on. But the government, the Department of like Agriculture is really slow dragging their heels. It's been years that they've been trying to get a policy in place, but
there's some complications with, there's a thing pretty much in any jurisdiction that one piece of legislation can't override or contradict another. So if they use the Wildlife Act to say you can't have domestic sheep where there's wild sheep, the Right to Farm Act says you can do whatever you want on private land, basically, for farming operations. So one can't tell the other act what it can and can't do. So that's my understanding over the years of
where the
standoff has been. And then it's people like yourselves and Wild Sheep Society and Dr. Helen Swancha and stuff that are on the ground, you know, appealing to the good hearts of ranchers and developing, you know, these protocols and testing private sheep herds and stuff. And you're right in there, man. You're right in the mix of all of these amazing conservation stories as a hunter and seeing it as part of your job as well. So
yeah, thank you. Super neat to be involved. Well, no, thank you. Thank you for spreading the word.
Thank you for the work that you do. It's you're not just like a volunteer that shows up and, you know, can you park the truck over here? Can you stand here and whatever? I mean, you're a highly skilled, highly trained, thousands of captures, thousands of hours in your machine.
I feel blessed.
Super important to conservation.
Feel privileged.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. And it's so clear. It's so clear talking to you that, like, this is a hunter that's talking about this. You know, I could see what you said at the beginning of the podcast where you try to train other pilots or whatever. But if that passion's not there of like, hey, man, like, we got to get this today. Yeah. And, you know, we got to get two more tomorrow and wrap up and have the extra because there's cougar predation in this area. And a couple of these collared animals are probably going to die. And you're just... Yeah. Yeah, we got to make this happen. Like, we got to get to the top of the mountain. We got to see what's in that basin type attitude.
Yep, that's exactly it, Mark. Yep.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, it's so wonderful. It's so refreshing to have folks like yourself, a hunter, that's part of these critical wildlife conservation research projects. Hopefully some of the biologists that you're working with too, the net gunners and stuff, are also hunters and they got that same passion. It's not just a job.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Because it goes so much further. If a person's passionate about it, you'll do a good job, right?
No,
that goes with anything. Yeah.
Yeah, because the true passion, you know, of hunters and conservation is you're always thinking about the next generation, right? Like, and that's kind of where our motivation comes from. And you got young kids and you're probably thinking the same thing when you're out there every day, I bet.
Yeah, that's right.
Very cool. Very cool. Ben, thanks so much for sharing with everybody what you do and your passion. And hopefully folks can hear that. I'm sure they can, because sitting here looking at you, you know, it's like we're telling hunting stories. Like, you just got that, you know, your face is just lit up talking about this stuff. I can just see that how much you love what you do.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mark, for spreading the word. Yeah, you're always talking about some pretty interesting topics.
So, well, this is a super interesting topic, and meeting you and introducing you to everybody. So where can folks find you on Instagram?
With you
and the company?
Well, you can find me on Instagram, Canadian Wildlife Capture. Look it up on there. We've got a website, CanadianWildlifeCapture.com. Where else? Phone me up.
That's the main ones where people can follow along with the professional work that your team does every winter. And you take great photographs, and I always look forward to seeing your photographs and the wildlife work and stuff. They're very professional. So find them, folks. Find Canadian Wildlife Captures on Instagram and follow along this winter on the great work that they're doing.
Yeah, Ben. And join a group, whoever it is. Like, if it's Wild Sheep Society BC, which is this, you know, they're doing all kinds of stuff. Or there's a bunch of other groups like Hunters for BC, BC Wildlife Federation, of course, is a big one. Even just joining those groups, supporting those groups, because numbers and a small financial support goes a long way. So those numbers mean a lot, for sure. And I know that there's still a lot of hunters out there that. You know, they probably have the same attitude and the same feelings, but if you don't speak up and support some of the groups that are speaking up, yeah, it just kind of falls away, right? We need to make sure that we have a voice, and hunters and outdoor enthusiasts stick together, because I think that that's a common one too, is we're always battling amongst each other and not supporting just the general overall lifestyle and things that are important to all of us, of course.
Yeah, that's a good that's a good message to end on. And folks, you can reciprocate. So when you find when you find Canadian Wildlife Captures on Instagram, go on, make a comment, say, hey, thank you. Thanks for the work that you guys are doing. And you're putting yourselves out there. So give them a little, give them a little thumbs up, fist bump there on social media, and tell the whole crew that you're thankful for the work that they all do in conservation. Ben, thanks so much for joining me here this morning, and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you. And
yeah, Merry Christmas to you and your family, and enjoy that Christmas dinner. That sounds exciting.
You still got time to change the menu for your family for Christmas. So good luck with that one.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.